As you know, there is a book by John F. Kennedy called Profiles in Courage. And it's really a story of people who do things their own way, who take on the establishment. And my guest is kind of like that in motion pictures, because he does things his own way. He takes on pictures that people laugh at, and he has the last laugh, because they become huge successes. His name is Don Rugoff, and he's done everything in the motion picture business. He's produced motion pictures, he distributes through his company, Cinema 5, and he owns in New York some of the most important and prestigious theaters, Cinema 1, the Cinema 2, the Sutton, the Beekman, the Plaza, just to name a few. Well, Don is my guest tonight. I'm going to ask him to talk to us about a lot of things, specifically how he fights to get motion pictures, how he distributes motion pictures. But the most important thing, the thing he does better than anyone else in the business, is how he markets and sells a motion picture. Because the ads that Don Rugoff does for his motion pictures, I think, are extremely distinctive and known to you all. My guest, Don Rugoff. What happens, especially these days, in trying to get product to keep a distribution arm that you have selling some pictures each year?
Well, I think it's really the most amazing thing, because we're desperate sometimes for a movie and looking all over, screening movies whenever we can find them. And then all of a sudden, somebody calls up on the phone and he says, I want to show you a movie called Monty Python and the Holy Grail. And it's shown at Filmex in Los Angeles, their film festival, and it was shown twice at midnight, and it sold out both times. It was the first film to sell out in the whole festival. And I asked them, who sent you to us? You know, how'd you come to us? I know we're always the last company anybody ever comes to with their film, because they offer it to the major companies first and the other large independent companies. And he said, the majors sent us here. And that's how we found Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Or my favorite story, I guess, is Endless Summer, which was a film on surfing that a man named Bruce Brown made in California. He had gone touring up and down the coast with a series of surfing films that he'd made. A guy named Paul Allen had gone in ahead of him each time, rented the theater, done the advertising, you know, put up the posters, and Bruce came and he narrated the film live. And as he did it each time, he found out what the audience liked, what made them laugh, what they enjoyed, and he made a film called Endless Summer, and he narrated that one up and down the coast too, and then he blew it up to 35. He came into Wichita, Kansas, and he tested the film there because it was 3,000 miles from any surf. And the manager said to him, you got to have girls with bikinis in the air. You just can't have two guys with a surfboard. And Bruce said, let me run my own ad. You know, I know what I want to do. And the picture broke the theater record. It topped My Fair Lady in the theater. Nobody would buy the picture. And he came to New York, and he showed it to a man who was our film buyer at the time. And film buyer said he liked it very much. He wanted to show it to me. And one day I read in the New Yorker and in Time magazine the same day, great reviews on this picture. And I went to see it that night at the theater. And when I got there, he said to me, what are you doing here, Rugoff? You've seen the picture, right? And I said, I don't think I have. Why do you say that? He said, you saw the picture and you said it was a 20-minute short. And I said, I don't think I've seen the picture. But I said, if I saw the picture, I'll come out and I'll tell you. So I went in and saw it, and the theater was filled with blonde kids, all blonde. I never saw anything like it. A lot of them on crutches. And he had the gall in a 90-minute movie to have an intermission. I'd never seen that before. I thought that was really something. And I watched the kids pour out to the candy machine. And I thought the theater owner is going to be very happy about his concession business.
Because it wasn't your theater.
Right. And when I came out, I told him, you know, I said, I've never seen that movie before. And we made a deal that night to distribute the movie. He was down to his last dime, literally, at that point. He had paid the money to make the blow up from 16 millimeter to 35 millimeter. He'd hocked his house. He'd sold his car. He'd done everything. And they were in their second week. They had done business the first week. They'd gotten some good reviews. But finding films, I think, is really most of the fun. You know, I walked into a screening room that somebody sent me to at the Cannes Film Festival. There were three people in the theater. And it was a picture called El Vermagon. And I came outside, and it's a double suicide at the end of the film. And I came outside, and a news guy was hawking a newspaper saying, double suicide in Nice Harbor. And I thought the producer had arranged that, you know, as a little touch. And I came back to see it a second time, and we thought the screens were really being very, very hard on us. They wanted $100,000 for the picture, you know, and that was really a fortune. Because it's a very special kind of movie, you know, very slow-moving, very beautiful. We didn't know what the audience was, and finally we said, okay, we'll take it, but that's it. That's all we'll pay you. You know, you won't get any part of the film rental after that. You know, it's outright. And they were so greedy that they said yes. And that picture went on to an awful lot of volume of business. And I think they've been kicking themselves ever since. But it's really, I don't know, it's just fun to find movies.
Okay. When you get a film, when you take a film like a Monty Python, or Scenes from Marriage, whatever, what goes into the decision of how to sell that film?
Well, lately we've been trying to pick films on the basis of feeling we know who the audience is. We, for instance, on Swept Away, which was a very kind of fun, sophisticated film by Leon Rettmiller. We felt that the audience for it was just, you know, that group of people who would be looking for something that was very interesting and alive and sophisticated. And we had a good poster for it, I thought, you know.
Great campaign.
And the same thing happened with Seven Beauties. We thought the audience for that was more serious and more, you know, profound audience. And not as popular. You know, it wouldn't reach as many people. We try to buy a movie knowing who we think we can sell it to. Monty Python, we felt we could certainly reach the television audience, you know. And at that time, the picture, the series, Monty Python series was playing all around the United States on educational stations.
Not anywhere near as much as after the film, though, right?
No, it was. You know, I was amazed at how many people knew Monty Python. Even in cities which didn't have an television where we opened. We gave out so many coconuts on that picture that at one point I think we had a monopoly on the coconuts in it. The Scenes from Marriage, we just thought anybody interested in the subject of marriage, and we had a star at the moment, and we had a great director coming off Prize of Whispers.
Well, let me ask you first, on Scenes from a Marriage, how did that come to pass? How did you get that film?
That was an incredible story. John Springer is a publicity man who represents a lot of famous stars. I don't know, he represents Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton still.
Yeah.
And a lot of other people. And he always, when he's on a plane, he tears newspapers apart on the whole trip because he's cutting out clippings for his people. You know, he represents a lot of people. So on one plane trip like that, he came across an article by Charles Champlin, who's kind of the dean of the critics, I think, around the country. He's a critic for Los Angeles Times. Charles Champlin said in this review that he walked into a screening room where they were screening a movie called Scenes from Marriage, and he watched this four-hour movie, and it grew and grew and grew and grew in strength, and he was just terribly impressed with it at the end. So we called up the agent for the film immediately, and Bergman had cut it down from the original 5 hours to 4 hours. It was here to be sold to television because it had been shown on television in Sweden. Well, none of the American networks wanted the film, and he couldn't sell it to the agent, so we asked the distributor. And then we took the film up to Dartmouth to test it at Dartmouth College in honor of a 90-year-old professor up there whom I just love, Arthur Mayer. And at that time he was 88. And Pauline Kael happened to be there teaching that day. And she came to the screening, which I didn't really want to do because I don't like critics to see a movie, you know, until we're ready to show it to them, but couldn't ask her to stay away. And at the end of the intermission, I remember coming up to Pauline to see what she thought, and she was in pretty good shape. She was running to use the bathroom, and she said, "It's okay, it's okay." But at the end of the movie, we had lost the audience because in the second 2 hours, it was just too long a period of time, and the film didn't hold up. There was a one-hour divorce scene. So we contacted Bergman after much discussion in our office, and so on. We asked if we could show his two different movies. Well, he didn't want that at all, and he contacted us back and said, "I'd rather cut the movie for you." Well, we'd been afraid to ask him that from the beginning. So here he was telling us he'd do the very thing we wanted. And I had understood from his agent that he wanted a list of the cuts that we wanted him to make a suggestion. So we wrote him a letter suggesting the cuts. So when I met him in Stockholm for the first time, and I saw the film after I'd met him, he said he hadn't received our letter until after he made the cuts. And all of the cuts that we had recommended, of course, were in there. But beyond that, he had taken the film from 4 hours to 2 hours and 40 minutes, and I thought it was the most brilliant piece of editing I'd ever seen. And he told me it was the toughest piece of editing he'd ever had to do. But the whole film, I'm hoping, will be shown on Channel 13, I think this coming year, or this coming fall, and it's, I think, 5 60-minute segments. So if you've seen this feature, you can see what it's like, you know, in its original
real form.
I don't know why we bought America at the Movies, and I'm very unhappy about it right now because we just got run out of New York by the critics on that one, and yet we thought the audience on that one would be a very large one, the people who loved, you know, entertainment and fun. There was a guarantee made with that film, which is seldom done in New York because people don't trust New Yorkers. We guaranteed your money back if you didn't like it. I wanted to do it very big. I wanted to sell it very large because I wanted to get people in to see the picture. I knew the picture played beautifully with an audience. And I was dissuaded from doing it on a very big scale because I was told it would look like an act of desperation. I wanted to run a huge ad and said, "Nobody trusts New Yorkers. And we believe in our movie so much that we're willing to give you your money back if you don't like it." And I was told that's an act of desperation. People will see that ad and they'll figure you're in terrible trouble and they won't go to take advantage of your offer. The title is Death because a lot of people don't like the word America and it's not America. And I don't know what the hell America the Movies is. And it's a movie festival. I have all those drawbacks going for it. But we try to overcome it, you know. And I do think that we were ridden out of town by the critics. Now, they really took off on that movie. And they took off on the man who made it, George Stevens, Jr., because John Simon had a character assassination in New York Magazine. The problem is that we spent most of our time in movie advertising going out of our way not to tell you what the movie is about. Now, I've done research on audiences, and I always find that the audience says, "We want to know what the movie is about." But it seems to me in our particular business, we go out of our way not to tell you what the movie is about. And I can go back over many, many ads we've had, you know, which tell you absolutely zero about what the movie is about.
Like the most successful film you ever had, which has a Z on it.
Right.
You may see the body if you look closely.
Right. Well, a lot of the ads didn't have a body in it.
Just had a Z.
So I think this is a problem of the industry. I think we sell dreams, And if we try to tell somebody what the dream is about, it may not sound good to that person, so we don't tell them what the dream is about. We try to get them to come and see the dream. And it's a very complicated problem, because I know that we should tell you that it's a compilation of 92 films with 82 stars. But we're afraid to tell you that, because if we tell you that, you'll say, I already saw that with That's Entertainment and That's Entertainment 2, and I don't want to see that movie. I don't care if you tell me it's got more stars than That's Entertainment, it's more interesting. I don't want to see it. So I don't tell you that. So I'm now trying to think of something else to tell you that will get you to come. And that's our problem in the business.
What are the practical problems involved in bringing it back with a new ad campaign and possibly with a title change?
Well, the American Film Institute's head, George Stevens, Jr., has refused to let us change the title today. And I must say, in his defense, that we have not been able to better the title. We've tried very hard to better the title, and it's been driving us up the wall, and we haven't found a title that really is better. We're testing ad campaigns, two different ad campaigns. One I call the ad campaign, it's the That's Entertainment ad campaign, I call it that because it reminds me very much of That's Entertainment, and we stole the ad campaign from it. And the other ad campaign is a popcorn box. And I think a popcorn box is a marvelous symbol for movies, and everybody thinks of popcorn movies. And we got a marvelous artist to do a popcorn box based on a popcorn box we sell in the theaters. And we're going into three cities, Indianapolis Wednesday, Wichita, and Albuquerque. And in two of the cities, we're trying the popcorn, which is my favorite because it's original. It's not copying That's Entertainment. And in the other city, we're doing the That's Entertainment campaign. That should be very interesting to see the results of. If none of those campaigns work, I'm going to fold my tent and steal quietly away.
One of the frustrating things about being in the film business is that there are times that you know you have, or you feel you have, an audience picture. There's no question. That's why you bought it. That's why you've invested your money. Anybody who sees it likes it. The question is how you get them in the theater.
We ran a lot of radio spots. One of the radio spots had my voice on it. And we did not use TV. However, we were reviewed on television.
One of the people, as I was walking around, asked specifically to understand, because we haven't discussed, what sub-distributors are all about, and do you use them at all, and how does it work?
Yeah, we do use sub-distributors around the country. There are two ways that people distribute normally. One is they have offices of their own in key cities around the country, and that's the major film companies have what's called branch offices in Philadelphia, in Boston, in Atlanta, in every major city in the country. Then there are companies like ours, which are independents, which we have a 61-year-old former Army WAC sergeant running our distribution division, Frances Spielman, and she was formerly the bookkeeper, and we had an executive leave us an expensive, high-powered, high-priced gentleman, and we put Frances in charge, and she's been doing a great job ever since. And that's all there is. It's just Frances and her secretary.
Would you explain how sub-distributors work and percentages a little bit and give an idea of how it generally makes...
Well, there's a guy who handles New England for us, and he operates out of Boston. His name is Friedman.
Arthur Friedman.
And he and his partner,
Roger Lockwood,
handle the New England territory. Now, they get from the... First showing in Boston, they get 5% because normally Essence is the number one, what's called key town.
Of the distributor share.
And they get 5% of the net, because in our deals, the advertising comes off first, and then they share. And they shouldn't get more than 5% because we do all the work in the first run. Normally we book the theater ourselves and we do the advertising. We have cooperative advertising people
in the office, two very bright young people who do nothing but set the campaigns around the country in every city. Then they get 17.5% in every other town of England. And the big towns for them in England are Hartford, Springfield, New Haven, and to a lesser degree, Worcester. And I think that Stanford is not, I don't know if they get the money from Stanford, Connecticut, but it's normally booked out of New York, as is Westport, Connecticut. And Providence, Rhode Island is in their territory. And then they have smaller towns like Burlington and Vermont, which can do pretty well in a picture, or Great Barrington. You know, you begin to think Lowell, Massachusetts is one of the best towns in the country. Lawrence, Massachusetts is called. They do very big in Cambridge, Massachusetts, after Boston is played. It's a good territory in England. A lot of very intelligent people. And that man, if he does a good job, can earn a lot of money in a year's time. Then we have a man who really makes a lot of money if we do well, who has the 13 western states, and he maintains an office in San Francisco and in Los Angeles, and he covers California, state of Washington, Oregon, Nevada,
Utah,
Colorado,
Montana,
Wyoming, New Mexico,
Arizona.
Colorado, yeah, it's a huge territory. And he makes maybe over $100,000 a year, I think easily, maybe $150,000. And he was a former salesman for MGM, who we hired. And we have a man who's a sub-distributor in Atlanta, and he handles Georgia and Florida and Mississippi and Alabama. And then we have a man in Washington who handles Washington, D.C., and he handles the Philadelphia area. And
but the country, as you can see, is pretty well divided up.
And one of our best guys in Dallas, Texas, and he handles that's a very strange territory. He handles Texas, which is a great state for business. The people in Dallas and Houston love movies.
And Austin University.
Austin is a great town. And you can do very great business in San Antonio. And then he handles Oklahoma. Oklahoma is his territory. And New Orleans is his territory, which always amazed me. And Nebraska is his territory. So it's kind of divided. Not as you might think, and even an area, but we have a woman who works for us who handles, I believe, Indiana, and that's all. She doesn't even handle Cleveland, it's handled by somebody else.
They don't work for you exclusively, though. That
no, right? They handle everybody's pictures. The more pictures they can handle, the more profitable their company is, you know, their own operation is. And I've often told people who are looking for work, why don't you become an independent sub-distributor, because that's an awfully lucrative way of making a living. And you can live in your own hometown. You don't have to go live in New York or Chicago or some big city. Yeah.
You ever understand that concept? Let me just kind of just briefly say that most major studios, all major studios, have a very huge distribution company where they maintain offices and pay for the salesmen and the people who book films and sell the films all over the country. Smaller people cannot afford or do not want to spend that kind of money, which is a tremendous amount of money, to maintain distribution companies, especially if you only have two or three pictures a year. You're paying people 52 weeks a year. You're paying office rent and everything else. And so sub-distributors around the country are formed who are experts in pockets of the country, taking areas like New England, and what they do is take a percentage of the money, and they handle more than one film or one company's film. And sometimes they can have, as Don Rugoff points out, extremely good years if they happen to hit very well.
They make a fortune, some of them.
They can.
Yes.
So they're more or less brokers then for the industry.
Not brokers. They are our sales force. In other words, that's our. If you want to book a film, if you want to book a film in Texas, you call up Dallard Films in in Dallas, and you speak to Fred Beiersdorf, when he's paid, it's not the box office, it's what Julian calls the distributor's gross, and which I call the distributor's share. And it's after the advertising, because we spend a lot of money with our pictures because nobody's ever heard of them. And when they go into a new town, nobody ever heard of our movie, so we've got to establish it all over again in each city. We don't have Steve McQueen or Paul Newman or Robert Redford or people like that.
He did have Paul Newman. He did have Steve McQueen in the movie, but he couldn't advertise that he did.
Accepting every exhibitor in the country put his name on the market.
Right. It was called On Any Sunday.
They don't put up one nickel. They don't put up a penny of advertising money. They don't buy one print. They don't back you with one dime. Now, years ago, there used to be something called States Writers. And they used to buy your film for that territory.
Joe Levine, most famous States Writer.
Nowadays, these fellows open up their business, get a phone and a secretary and some office space, and they're a sub-distributor. They haven't put up a penny. That's why I like the business. It's a fast way to get rich.
Distribution patterns in even New York City have changed. When I first started buying for theaters, the idea was to have long runs even as a theater owner. You'd want to run 20, 30 weeks on a theater. Now, in Manhattan, it's not comparable to what Mr. Rudolph's talking about. On the other hand, most people now in distribution want a picture to go in, establish the film, and 10 or 12 weeks later want to break it into the suburbs.
I don't agree with that, of course.
Well, it's happened, though. It's a fact.
It's a fact that they do. And
I didn't say it was good. I didn't say it was good or bad. That's just what's happening.
It's too bad. You know, they're hungry for money, so they move it fast.
Someone had a question over here. Yes.
How bad is employee stealing in theaters? And how does the concession system work?
Well, I can't address myself really intelligently to employee stealing because it's very hard for me to know how much there is since I don't catch them. But when we catch them, we find out how much there is. And I think, unfortunately, in this business, it's not a foolproof system, because when you have tickets that can be sold, and they can be sold by the cashier and palmed by the doorman, who gives you somebody else's stub, and he brings the ticket to the cashier, and then she resells it. And the classic example today was I got a letter from somebody in Philadelphia about one of our Philadelphia theaters, saying that he had attended a performance, and he gave the date and the time. And he said one of the tickets came out of the machine, and the other ticket was loose on the person's lap, and it was handed out to me. And he said the tickets weren't on the same number. Mm-hmm. They weren't on the same consecutive numbers.
Yeah.
And he said, I'd like you to look into this matter, this irregularity, and get back to me. And he gave his name and address. That's very rare that that happens. And my first suspicion always is I get a letter like that, that it's somebody who's a disgruntled former employee who's got it for one of the people working there or something. But I don't know how much stealing there is. I suspect that the man who headed a circuit who once said, I hope they leave enough for me, may have been close to the mark. As to concessions in theaters, they're very profitable if you're doing a lot of business. And you should figure that the film companies don't get any part of that business. You keep it all yourself. That's why Endless Summer was so popular with theater owners, because in the middle of the movie, it stopped, and they went out to the candy counter and had refreshments, and then came back and watched the rest of the movie. Drive-In, the most famous for concessions, because they specialize in trailers about the food. And in the intermission, they put on a large amount of food on the screen to tempt you into coming into the concession area. Yes.
What's the reason for the recent uprising in the dollar movie?
Well, they can afford to show films for a dollar because they double the amount of people or triple the amount of people who are coming. And I'm just in love with that policy because where we had the Gramercy Theater that was once a really hot theater, and we were thrilled with the theater, it began to tail off for some reason. We couldn't put our finger on. We were getting $2.50 in the matinee, $3 a night. And then we went into a dollar policy, and we were getting literally three times the number of people coming. There were long lines all the time, you know.
And concessions are good.
And concessions are good. But more than that, when a theater is full and you're watching a picture with an audience, particularly if it's a comedy, you know, the picture plays better. It has to play better. It's more fun. So, and word gets around. It's a bargain, and people love a bargain.
The idea of saturation booking is a very, very good one if you, first of all, if you have a lot of money. When Paramount picked up a film that was certainly questionable called Survive, that's how it was sold. Survive was sold in one of the great campaigns I've ever seen since I've been in the business. Not because I'm with Paramount. I had nothing to do with the picture whatsoever. But they took an ad. They didn't in any way say that it was a foreign dub film or anything like that. It said Survive. It was about cannibalism. They went and spent a fortune on, we went and spent a fortune on television and radio. And an awful lot of money was made.
How many prints do you make, and what about shipping and storage?
There's a company that ships the films for us and stores them. We try to limit the number of films in our case, because we're a small little company, on a picture until we see how it does. If it's a big picture, if we think we're going to make a lot of money, we use up a lot of prints. We may make 350 prints on a film, that many. 50. It's a lot of money, because each print could be $700, depending on how long it runs. So we do it as we go along. And if it's summertime and we want to get the summer in, we do make up a lot of prints to play all those theaters. Yeah.
Do you open in New York the same time you open in Los Angeles?
No.
In our pictures, we do it like one step at a time, one brick at a time. We open New York, and then if we see how it does in New York, we'll go on to Boston and Washington. And then if we see we're doing well in Boston, Washington, San Francisco, and at the same time, we'll begin to maybe go into other cities, you know. We're not a company that's geared up to go in 500 cities with 500 theaters, you know, the same day. We don't like that kind of thing. It's too nerve-wracking. Yes.
Do you ever transfer an ad campaign?
Yes. We send out the radio spots. We send out the one sheets, which are put in the theater fronts, you know, and we send out people to help mobilize publicity, talk to the disc jockeys, make sure there's an advanced screening. You know, we invite everybody in the town to see the picture in a preview.
Opinion makers, supposedly, huh?
We tie in with the radio stations in the town. No change in the campaign, necessarily. Now, there are pictures where you may change your campaign that you use in New York and you say it's too sophisticated for the rest of the country and you'll change your campaign. On America, the movies, popcorn is popcorn.
What's the profile of the audience seeing foreign films?
There's no real profile except intelligence. In other words, it's got nothing to do with wealth. It's got to do with intelligence. And these films find a market and a home where there's an intelligent group of people, and with a bunch of dummies, nobody goes to see foreign films or art films. That's the truth, you know. People used to tell me, I bet you do well in these wealthy communities. Got nothing to do with money.
What percentage of the distributor's cost is used for market research?
I don't know. You know, I have a famous story about that. Because in Riverdale, New York, two supermarket chains went in to decide whether they wanted to take a store there. And Food Fair spent $50,000 on a survey. Anywhere they went, they spent $50,000 before they went in. And they spent $50,000 in Riverdale. And sometimes they threw it away if they didn't go. Dade Shopwell went in and they got out of the car and they walked around the neighborhood and they counted the Chinese restaurants and they try to see if their kind of people were in the neighborhood. Each supermarket chain went after it their own way, and each supermarket chain opened a store in Riverdale, and they both died. and that's market research.
Well, one thing I'd like to know is, how do you usually tell the distributor to work harder?
Well, we call them every day and threaten them. It's true.
And what do you threaten them with?
Taking the films away.
I mean, we don't do that, but he gets the message, because he'll get a phone call from Francis, this 61-year-old former Army wax sergeant, and then I'll call him, and then he'll come to a meeting, you know, and gradually the message permeates through.
Also, he's getting a pretty good flow of product if you look at Don Rugoff's films.
Yeah, he wants to do a job because he wants to keep the product.
He wants to keep the product.
They get very unhappy if you take it away from him.
Yes.
How much does it cost to hold an exhibition house in San Francisco?
To build a theater like that today? I don't know. Nobody's built one in New York in a long time, but I'll bet you it'd be $800,000 to do it right. We're building a theater in the Plaza Hotel. There's 203 seats, and we're a public company, and I'm not permitted to give you the figure, but I wouldn't want to anyway, because it's so expensive. It's just costly today. Everything costs more.
You'll be the first to know about Cinema 3.
Cinema 3 is the name of the theater. It's going
is
in
it the
800 to 900,000 to build a theater the size of the Guaranteed Day. Didn't cost that way. You know, didn't cost one third of that when it was put up, you know. But the costs are just crazy today. Seat costs. I remember when we used to build the seats for $25, $30. Today we're looking at seats at $60, same chair.
How often do films get outdated?
It depends on the film, of course, but I believe it does. I think films get outdated very quickly today. Yeah.
Most films have to go fast, and you get the life of your film is generally the first 18 months you'll get your money.
People have changed in America, and they might like it this fall, not like it next spring.
Someone all the way back had a question. Yes.
Do you package the short subjects with your feature, and is there a commercial market left for a packaged short subject for a particular feature?
Yeah, there's a commercial market for short subjects if they are just what you said, packaged with a particular feature.
Yeah.
So the answer is yes, there's a market if you can put it together with the right picture.
Okay, we'll take three more questions, and then we're going to break up. Yes.
Do you use text in your advertising campaigns?
There's a shot of a bodybuilder with his hands up in the air. It's on the cover of a book called Pumping Iron. That's, to me, terrific, which I would use as a poster in an ad campaign. And we did that on trash, and we took Joe D'Alessandro with a handkerchief, you know, around his head and his body, and we just put above it a quote from the Village Voice called A Beautiful Funky Movie. So it's fun doing that kind of image ad, and that's how we do it. We try to come up with a simple image, and then if we get a good quote, we stick it on, and that's our ad campaign. How do you become a sub-distributor, SUV, sub-distributor? What you do is you have to learn how to be a film salesman first, and you have to get a job with a film company selling film. Paramount, Warner Brothers, United Artists. You try and find the company which has the best reputation for selling movies. And one of the companies today that has the best reputation is United Artists. James Beldy, the head of United Artists, is considered the premier general sales manager in the business, followed very closely by a gentleman named High Martin at Universal. And these men, over the years, have proven themselves to be money winners. And you work there, and you work hard, and one day, when you know enough about the business, You go to some people like me and you say, I'm starting up my own office. Would you give me your pictures? You know, I'm very honest. I work very hard. You call my company. You can check my record. And if we're not happy with the person that we're working with in that town, we might be very happy to give you our pictures. It's really not hard. I don't think there's any magic to this.
No. In fact, the person that's distributing for Mr. Rugoff in New England did just that. He worked in Boston for United Artists, left United Artists, and now has Mr. Rugoff's product there. Yes.
I noticed you kept changing your campaigns and the manna fell to earth.
Change it every week. I kept hitting a different audience each week when I changed it. I was pulling in each part of the audience. My business went up as I hit a particular nerve, you know, and I found an audience. And I was desperate to find audiences all summer. Which had a problem. It opened like gangbusters. if you looked at our release book, you know, and you saw each town, the first week would be like that, I was telling you to you. And then the second week would be like this. Well, that's purely the film's problem, because people didn't understand it. That guy made the picture a little easy to understand. We would have done better. At the end, I was putting out a fact sheet. The audience explained the movie to them.
Thank you, Don Rudolph. Okay.